In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, the Bill Clinton diet. Is sitting on a bike bad for you? What is the best plastic for water bottles? Can you increase growth hormone with fasting? And much more.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. We provide you with everything you need to know for total performance, fat loss, recovery, digestion, sleep, brain, and hormone optimization. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you just want to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
There, Ben. How are you feeling there, you old feller?
I feel like I've been podcasting for 300 episodes, Brock.
300 episodes.
300.
Built up in me sciatica.
I need some podcast Viagra. I'm beginning to go limp.
I went limp like 100 episodes ago, you lucky bugger.
Seriously, though, dude, we've made it 300 friggin' episodes. And as a matter of fact, for those of you listening in, we've probably done more than 300 episodes because for every episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, there's usually a special episode. Mm-hmm. So we've actually done like probably close to 600 episodes. It's crazy.
Probably more than 600.
Yeah.
It's like there were times like when I was away that we didn't put a number on it and we didn't count those. We need to hire somebody out there who wants to just like do it for the love, should count all of our episodes for us.
Well, in 2008, when I was a personal trainer, a fledgling young personal trainer, full of life
then,
and vigor.
Reckon we had to walk uphill both directions to the podcasting studio through barbed wire in our bare feet in the snow.
We used two tin cans to communicate.
Anyways, 2008, I remember recording my first podcast and trying to figure out how to upload it. I don't even remember if iTunes existed. I think it did. But yeah, man, I've been podcasting for 6 years. It's nuts.
It's awesome.
Almost 7 years.
It's good. Yeah. I've only been with the show now for, well, 3 years last week, I think it actually was. So I'm only half as tired and worn down as you are.
Happy anniversary, Brock. I'll send you a magazine subscription or something.
Sweet. So your Twitter feed right now is completely overrun by something that we'll talk about a little bit later, but you still managed to squeeze in a few pretty cool studies this week.
Yes, I accidentally blew up Twitter, and I'll tell folks why later on. But in the meantime, let's talk about a few of the things that I tweeted this week over at twitter.com/BenGreenfield. And this is the latest and the greatest and the best of the best. The first is our near and dear ex-US president, Bill Clinton, used to be vegan. And I tweeted that he actually went from vegan to low-carb paleo. And there was a very interesting article that appeared about this in The Inquisitor. And it sounds like Bill was actually influenced by Hillary, who introduced him to Dr. Mark Hyman. Hillary introduced Bill to Dr. Mike Hyman. And Mark Hyman actually really wrote a very interesting article recently about he launched this new diet called the Pegan Diet, which he calls a mix between paleo and vegan. But I think it sounds like some kind of a devil-worshipping twist, maybe because it sounds like pagan. Anyways, though, Dr. Hyman...
Pagans don't worship the devil. That's a misnomer.
They do in my special twisted religious head.
Yes, sir.
So, anyways, Dr. Hyman told Bill Clinton that his vegan diet contained too much starch and insufficient good quality protein. And Bill Clinton switched to this paleo diet. And the article itself also talks about Anne Hathaway, another celebrity who was not, for those of you who are not familiar with the U.S., a president. She's actually an actress. But Anne Hathaway said that she didn't feel good. She didn't feel healthy on a vegan diet. And I have no clue if she was doing it correctly. As we've talked about before, there's a way that you can really F up a vegan diet by
absolutely
doing it incorrectly. But
tons of tofurkey.
She's also doing eggs and sausage for lunch now. Anyways, though, so I thought it was really interesting how Dr. Hyman is now preparing the Clintons, especially Mrs. Clinton, if she decides to run for president, which is somewhat likely. He's having them carry things like macadamia nut butter, walnut butter, turkey jerky, and cans of wild salmon as they jet about the globe. So it's interesting. Total switch from vegan to paleo.
That's pretty awesome. Almost as awesome as you guys actually having a legendary funk musician as president.
What? What are you talking about?
Oh, Bill Clinton, not George Clinton. I always get them confused.
You
damn
must be Canadian. Okay. Anyways, let's talk about...
No, I'm just old.
Let's talk about diabetes. There was this really interesting study that came out that showed that light, and specifically sunshine, could reduce your risk of developing diabetes. And this was quite interesting. They found that there was a direct link between sun exposure and decreased risks of type 2 diabetes, decreased fasting glucose, better glucose tolerance, and decreased amounts of fasting insulin. And this is partially linked to vitamin D deficiency and the fact that when you're deficient in vitamin D, you have increased diabetes risk. But sunlight specifically was what they looked at in this study, and they found a consistent link between lack of sunlight exposure and type 2 diabetes. The reason I think this is interesting is because a long time ago, I had this lady named T.S. Wiley on the podcast. And T.S. Wiley wrote this book called, it's something like Sleep, Sex, and Survival. I could be butchering the name, but it's approximately like that. And if it wasn't named that, it should have been, because I like that name. Anyways, though, she goes into how when it's summer, when you're exposed to a lot of light, when the days are longer, you actually have a better carbohydrate tolerance. In other words, your body is better able to handle carbohydrates with less of a surge in glucose and less of a surge of insulin released by the pancreas. And it turns out that one of the reasons that this may be the case is because as you are exposed to the sun, you get increased vitamin D expression, and that increased vitamin D expression helps you to be able to handle carbohydrates better. So nice. The other interesting thing, though, if you think about this from kind of like an evolutionary ancestral survival standpoint, is that if you are approaching a time of year when there's less sunlight exposure but still eating carbohydrates, you know, let's say you in the fall, you know, a lot of apples and pears and some of those, you know, fall/winter-based carbohydrates, you're eating those, more of them would technically be getting converted into body fat, right? Because you have lower vitamin D levels in the mm-hmm. fall and the winter. Yeah. And that would theoretically prepare you better for surviving the harsh cold in the winter.
Exactly. Yeah,
so it could be a little bit of a survival mechanism.
Central heating to turn on.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but unfortunately, we live in an era where we've got central heating and air conditioning and probably far, far more carbohydrates than just like the simple fruits that may have been available in the fall and the winter in like an ancestral time. But it's very interesting how sunlight and vitamin D are so linked. And this new study actually shows why that is the case. So as you approach the winter and the fall, you know, which in November, at the time this podcast is being recorded, we're going into, one of the things you may want to consider is adding vitamin D in to your diet, unless you're, you know, I don't know, snowboarding outside with your shirt off or in your bikini, which we know all our podcast listeners are bombing down the slopes in bikinis right now.
They better be.
They better be. Start into vitamin D. Use like a liquid vitamin D or, you know, a little bit of extra vitamin D, possibly over and above what you'd normally take, especially if you want to improve your glucose tolerance. So that was a pretty interesting study. And then interestingly, very much related to that, another article that came out about how sleeping naked could also cut your risk of diabetes. And this was a really interesting article. I'll link to it, but Your core temperature is at its highest at about 11 p.m., and it's at its lowest at 4 a.m., and if anything prevents that decline in temperature, you can struggle to get to sleep, you can have disturbed sleep, and you can also have a lower ability to burn calories as you sleep. So this all comes down to cold thermogenesis. And what these researchers found is that when you're able to drop the skin temperature by sleeping naked, your metabolism goes up and your fasted glucose is decreased when you wake up in the morning. So sleeping naked also, of course, has other benefits that they go into in the article, including giving your love life a boost.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to assume that that means sleeping naked with someone else in the bed with you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that sleeping naked all by yourself is going to give your love life a boost, unless you are simply maybe waking up happier than usual, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And also infections. It says wearing nothing to bed can help women to avoid developing yeast infections because thrush, a form of yeast, loves warm, restricted environments. So wear something loose or preferably nothing at all. So there's another reason to sleep naked, ladies. And that's actually what I'm going to tell my wife tonight before we go to bed, is that I'm concerned about yeast in her warm and moist spots. And so
you don't want to get thrush, baby.
I'd like you sleep naked. I don't want you to get thrush or diabetes. So take it off, baby. Take it all off. So one other interesting thing that I tweeted, and this was a hilarious video. That was
hilarious.
It was a TED Talk. And the TED Talk was actually called Help Fight Local Warming. I first saw this when I was over in Israel because it was delivered by this guy named Yossi Vardi, who lives over there in the Middle East. And what he talks about is the link between hot seats, laptops, cell phones, and sperm. And in this video, and perhaps we will actually play the audio clip of this video for you as you're listening in here in just a second, but it talks about how studies have shown that an increase of just 1 degree Celsius can affect sperm formation, and only 15 minutes of laptop use produced that temperature rise in guys' laps. And the video goes into more detail, but basically this is why I never ever put a laptop in my lap unless I've got one of those heat blocking, EMF blocking pads underneath it. These are like the little pads you can buy off of like Amazon, for example. I use one called a Hara pad. That's H-A-R-A pad. But you should watch this video or listen to the clip that we're about to play for you, because it's really quite interesting.
Important health message. Blogging may be hazardous to your health, especially if you are a male. This message is given as a public service. Blogging affects your posture. We start with the posture. This is the posture of ladies who are not blogging. This is the posture of ladies who are blogging. This is the natural posture of a man sitting squatting for ventilation purposes. And this is the natural posture of a standing man, and I think this picture inspired Chris to insert me into the lateral thinking session. This is male blogging posture sitting, and the result is, for greater comfort, men naturally sit with their legs farther apart than women when walking on laptop. However, they will adopt a less natural posture in order to balance it on their laps, which result in a significant rise of body heat between their thighs. This is the issue of local warming. This is a very serious newspaper. It's Times of England, very serious. This is a very... Gentlemen and ladies, be serious. This is a very serious research.
I get laughed at. Maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever. But I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lilacue.
Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Leela does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Leela Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Leela Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LeelaQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and your yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com.
Check it out.
Listener Q&A.
Hi, it's Ian here from Auckland, New Zealand. I'd like to thank Ben for his work. It's been fantastic and helped me a huge amount. Last season, a pair of us did a fundraising deal. We did 3 of New Zealand's iconic events. We did the Swim the Harbour, which is 3.2 Ks, Ride Round Taupo, which is 160 Ks or 100 miles, and we ran the Auckland Marathon. I used the Ironman training program because all of these events were done in a 1 month period. It also set me really nicely up for a half marathon leading up to the event. And then later in the season, I did my first half Ironman, which took me 5.5 hours at 5:28, nothing special, but I'm an age grouper and that put me fairly well in that field. Mostly I enjoyed the relatively low training hours for the amount of competition hours that I did, and in particular the strength work. The strength work set me up nicely. It helped me prepare myself and keep away from injuries, and I'd like to thank Ben again, and certainly very highly recommended.
Awesome. And speaking of tryripped.com, Brock, I've got you doing some pretty gnarly ripped workouts yourself.
I'm pretty sore. I'm having trouble raising my arms above my shoulders right now.
Yeah, I bring this up because Brock asked me. For those of you who don't know, I coach Brock. And one of the things that we always do in the off season is we introduce a new program for Brock to do. And now he's doing a 5x5. And mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's
last winter you had
twist.
Me doing that Mass Made Simple mm-hmm. or a variation on Dan John's program. Yep. And that was awesome. I didn't get super swole, but I sure got strong.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know what 5x5 is, it's very, very basic. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes to the basic page where you can – it's at stronglifts.com where you can download a basic 5x5 workout. But it's just a way to get very strong and put on some muscle mass pretty quickly in a very simple way. So essentially, you use free weights, not machines. You do compound multi-joint exercises, not single-joint isolation exercises. And you always add weight. You never add reps. So you're not training for a muscle pump. You're not training for soreness. You're just adding weight. Now, the original 5x5 routine was comprised of three exercises that are put into two full body workouts. And one workout was squat, bench press, and a barbell row. And mm-hmm. then the other workout was a squat, an overhead press, and a deadlift. The 5x5 workout that I've got Brock doing, we're putting all five of those lifts, the squat, the bench, the overhead press, the deadlift, and we're actually doing a clean instead of a row. But you do five sets of five reps of each of those exercises, and you do that 2 to 3 times a week with very heavy weights. And that's it. It's super simple. All the other workouts, for example, that I've got Brock doing our mobility workouts, some fasted morning cardio, a couple of high-intensity intervals, one day that's just yoga with some deep breathing, and then like an easy, light type of nature walk where he's just getting out in nature, exploring nature. And
why do you say it like that?
Have you seen the nature videos on YouTube?
No.
Oh, you gotta watch them. No. Go to YouTube and do a search for Nature Guy. Nature Guy. But it's pretty funny. It's pretty hilarious, actually. If you're listening in, also go to YouTube and do a search for Nature Guy. You will laugh your butt off. Anyways, though, the 5x5 workout that I've got Brock doing is a little bit of a twist on the traditional 5x5 workout, because rather than just sitting on his butt reading magazines or watching TV as he rests in between each
which
of those
sets.
Which
is what I normally do when I'm working out.
Well, that's actually what you see a lot of folks who are doing a 5x5 workout, right? They finish the five reps and they just kind of chill. But instead, I've got mobility thrown in between each of the different sets that you do. So for example, if you're going to do five sets of five squats, in between each set of the squats, rather than just sitting around, you do, for example, bird dogs, which is where you get down into a crawl position and you extend right arm and left leg, then left arm and right leg 10 times. And then in between your bench press, you'll do something like a foam roller for the back or an abdominal movement or something else that is putting work into your body and making your body better, but still allowing that muscle that you work during the 5x5 to recover. So I call it a 5x5 workout with mobility. So basically, that's what Brock's doing. I've got him sweating a few days a week with the 5x5.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting recovery ones that you have me doing is when I'm doing the deadlifts, you've got me doing like box jumps, which doesn't necessarily seem like a recovery activity. What's the theory there?
I will admit that there are a few of the 5x5 exercises where I am jacking your heart rate up a little bit. So occasionally, one of the things, there's two exercises that I'll mix with a deadlift sometimes. I'll mix it with box jumps or I'll mix it with rows on like a concept two. And if you want to make your 5x5 workout super hard, you do your five sets of heavy deadlifts, but in between each deadlift, you either do 10 box jumps or you do a 250-meter row. And it turns it into a little bit more of a suffer fest. So that was just my evil twist, Brock.
I really enjoyed that one. That was fun. It was, my living room was a disaster area after I finished the workout the other day.
Because you threw up all over it?
Yeah, I barfed everywhere. It was awesome. Actually, it smelt really bad too, because I've started using, like, I've been following your lead and started using coconut oil as my deodorant, just because I've worked my way through all of the natural, quote unquote, deodorants that I can possibly find, and they all make me smell worse than if I wear no deodorant at all. So I thought, I'm going to give the coconut oil a try. And now my living room, and actually right now my office, just smells like BO and coconut.
Like a giant stinky cookie. I like it.
Like the cookie that you would not feed your worst enemy.
Hey, Ben and Brock, it's Brian here from South Africa. Thanks for the great show and keep bringing us that awesome content. Recently, I was exposed to a term called glycobiology, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on the matter and if you see it as important as some people are saying it is for the future of our health. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
I have never heard the term glycobiology before.
You idiot.
I'm so dumb. Apparently, I don't listen to any podcasts about like health and fitness and science or anything like that. So really, like, it's not a surprise.
Glycobiology.
Does that have something to do with the Kardashians?
You have to say it as if you're narrating like a 1960s science video.
Glycobiology is one of the most important processes you will come across in scientific history.
Researchers all over the world are now looking into glycobiology as a way to fight the Cold War and stop nuclear disasters forever. Glycobiology. Even the housewives are using glycobiology in all of the latest and greatest cooking methods.
How was that?
That was awesome. The distortion was appropriate.
Glycobiology. Actually, so here's the deal with glycobiology. If you define glycobiology, it's just the biology of sugar chains. Okay, that's like glycans are what are called sugar chains in biology. You might also know them as saccharides, like monosaccharides or disaccharides or polysaccharides. And there's a lot of different ways that sugars can be stuck together. Now, the deal with glycobiology is that it's a growing field and I'm going to try and explain this in a way that's not super duper confusing, but there are molecules called glycoconjugates in your body, which are all these different kind of sugars that are stuck together. And typically, when someone is developing a drug or a pharmaceutical or something that's going to act upon one of these sugars, they focus on not the core chain of the sugar, what would be called, if you think of it like a tree with a bunch of branches coming off of it, they're not focusing on the scaffolding, on the tree itself, but rather on all of the different branches. That's what a drug or a pharmaceutical would work on. So they're focusing more on the things coming off of the tree than the tree itself, or what would be considered the scaffold. Mm-hmm. So when you look at glycobiology, what science is now finding is that you can actually you can target the tree itself rather than the branches coming off the tree when you're looking at one of these biomolecules, one of these what are called glycoconjugates. So what that means is that we all of a sudden can develop a bunch of new potential ways to fight against cancer, or potential, for example, vaccinations would be another field where this could come into play. Even ways that we could figure out how to fight against chronic diseases like diabetes, for example, by targeting the tree rather than the branches coming off the tree. And that's basically what glycobiology is. I know this is probably super duper boring for those of you who tune into this podcast so that you could burn fat faster, run faster. But the idea here is that they're now developing anti-flu drugs, anti-cancer drugs, etc., that focus on the core of these glycan chains rather than the sugars themselves. And that's basically what glycobiology is. Cool. As far as whether or not it's the wave of the future, etc., I have no clue. I do know that what they call the glycomics market, which is a market that's focused on like drug discovery and development and immunology and oncology and other applications that you can use glycobiology for. It does seem to be exploding. There's a recent article, and I don't know if this is the article that Brian read, but it was a recent article that came out that showed that the glycobiology, or what's called the glycomics market, is going to be exploding to almost $1 billion by 2019. COVID-19 in terms of all the different types of enzymes and instruments and kits that are being created to allow you to target the core of the sugar rather than the sugar chains themselves. So ultimately, I think it's an interesting question, but considering that in most cases, especially on this podcast, we're looking for natural solutions rather than drugs anyways. I mean, I'm all about preventive living when it comes to cancer and diabetes. So I'm still pretty obsessed with the whole like sleeping naked and getting sunshine thing than I am on developing glycobiology-based drugs. But if you're an investor looking for a field to invest in, it does seem to be quite promising and explosive when it comes to something that could blow up in the future as far as health research and the development of new drugs.
Where's my checkbook?
Hi, my name is Jonas Lövgren. I'm biking a mountain bike to work every day and have done so for many years. I would like to know how my sitting position should be. From the point of view of not getting any injuries later on. So not from biking the fastest or anything, but not to have problems with my back or my shoulders or anything else. So how should my shoulders be placed? Should I have a straight back or curved back? How should my saddle be positioned? I don't want to wake up 10 years from now and learn that, oh, you should have been sitting like this. That's why you have this bad injury or whatever. So any thoughts on this? Thanks a lot for a great show. Bye.
I like Jonas's style. He's not worried about going fast. He's not worried about being maximum efficiency or anything. He just doesn't want to screw himself over.
That's right. So you think he's talking literally about like his crotchal function?
I think he's talking about everything. His like testicles. He doesn't want to have like a broken back and knees and testicles.
Well, I mean, we could start with the big obvious here, and that's the fact that a bike seat for both men and women puts pressure on a bunch of the nerves and the blood vessels that are in your what's called your perineal area, and for men it's the back of your scrotum, and that has been shown to cause some pretty big problems, like mountain biking, for example, because the rough terrain can cause some really severe problems. They had one study that showed that 96% of male mountain bikers have what are called scrotal abnormalities.
Yikes.
Add that one to your
that's
vernacular.
Pretty much everybody.
Yeah, like calcium deposits and what are called sperm-containing cysts and twisted veins and all sorts of nasty issues.
Wait, what was it called again?
Scrotum. Scrotal abnormalities.
Yikes.
I think you have a new name for your band.
Yes.
Yes.
Totally.
So there was another study that found that the impact of cycling on the groin could lead to small scars within the scrotum and lower sperm production. Last week, we talked about how being a vegan can lower sperm production.
Being a crappy
vegan.
Turns
out probably the worst thing you could do is be a crappy vegan mountain biker when it comes to sperm.
That uses a laptop without a pad.
Yeah, or you could do that and avoid ever having a vasectomy again. So, low sperm counts and scrotal abnormalities from cycling. And then aside from contact with the bike seat itself, you get a bunch of heat generated in the groin area, and that can also impair your sperm function. So there's that, and then there's also, of course, the potential damage to your testicles and the surrounding area, and that's specifically nerve damage. This is why, you know, when I would train for Ironman and I'd do my longer bike days, I'd come home and, you know, my wife could have been wearing like a negligee lying on a bed of rose petals, you know, with you know, some sexy jazz music playing and
some Barry White.
Yeah. And I wouldn't have been able to do a thing about it because of the neuropathy, the nerve damage that can occur when you're riding for long periods of time. Essentially you can get impotent for short periods of time, which I think a lot of guys, for example, have been riding for long periods of time. And it can affect women's ability to orgasm or experience pleasure in the nether regions as well, just because of that neuropathy, that nerve damage. So you have what's called the pudendal nerve, and that's between your genitals and your anus. And it's responsible for sending information to your gonads and all the surrounding area. And the bike seat puts direct pressure. A traditional bike seat puts direct pressure on that pudendal nerve. And so you essentially are kind of like turning off all the nerves in that area of your body. So,
excuse me, I'm just going to go throw my bicycle away right now.
So when it comes to sperm production, impotence, neuropathy, things of that nature, you just go for a noseless saddle. I mean, like those are pretty easy to find these days. My favorite is a company called ISM. They make a saddle called the Adamo, and it's just a noseless saddle, and it's very, very comfortable. I discovered them a couple of years ago. That's primarily what I use. A lot of other bicycle seat manufacturers are switching to shorter noses now. So that's probably the best bet if you're concerned about this from like a sexual function standpoint.
So when you're sitting on that one, is your weight isn't on your pubic bone, it's on your sit bone? What are you sitting on now?
You're essentially spread across what would be called your ischial tuberosities, or kind of like the outside bones of your pelvic bone. And you're not on your perineum or the soft area of your crotch. So essentially your entire weight is supported by your pelvic bone, which makes sense. As far as other issues with the bike, obviously when you're sitting for long periods of time hunched over a computer, for example, right, your shoulders are hunched forward, you are leaning forward, your hip flexors are shortened. And if you think about it, you are replicating that position when you're on a bike, especially if you're like a triathlete, for example, riding in a time trial position, hunched over your aero bars for a long period of time. I think that the benefits, especially from a cardiovascular and a happiness and a getting out in nature and getting the wind in your face and the sun on your skin standpoint, I think all those pros outweigh the cons of like not biking. But I do think that from a biomechanical standpoint, you have to do things to reverse some of the potential muscle imbalances that can build up when you're riding, doing things like seated rows so that you're pulling your shoulders back after they've been hunched over on a bicycle, doing things like some really, really good lunging hip flexor openers, or better yet, using, for example, this is something I really like, the Core Foundation book by Dr. Eric Goodman, or the Core Foundation DVDs by Dr. Eric Goodman. I think every cyclist and every runner should be doing those as part of their program at least once a week. I personally do them 2 to 3 times a week. So I alternate every morning between doing yoga one morning for 10 to 15 minutes and doing these core foundation exercises by Dr. Eric Goodman 2 to 3 times a week. And that's a really, really good way to open up all the muscles that tend to get shortened when you're either riding a bike or you're hunched over a computer, two things that are part of my life. And so I do those in addition to making sure to do a lot of pulling. So seated rows, pull-ups, things of that nature. And then I'll stop every once in a while and do like a standing hip flexor stretch. So those would be the two main things that come to mind. Would be muscle imbalances and then some potential danger to the crotches of our dear listeners. So what I'll do in the show notes for people who want them over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/300, I'll put a link to the ISM Adamo saddle page where you can go kind of peruse some of their noseless saddles. And then also the Core Foundation book that I was just talking about, if you want some resources and you're a bicyclist who doesn't want to be impotent with an ugly body.
Hi, Ben and Brock, Mark from Philadelphia. I ride lots of miles on my bicycle, and I always have water bottles. I've seen some articles recently suggesting that even non-BPA plastics are dangerous to your health. I'm wondering if you have any recommendations about what water bottles to use. Thank you, and hope to hear from you soon.
So I guess, first of all, why is BPA bad? Like, why are we concerned about that in the first place?
Well, BPA is essentially, it's like an estrogen mimicker in the body. And that's something that we've known for a long time, that BPA or bisphenol A is basically a hormonal disruptor. They've done a huge, huge number of studies in terms of like cell culture studies, as well as in vivo studies in humans and epidemiological studies. And they've certainly found out that from an endocrinology standpoint, that BPA disrupts hormone production and can also cause, for example, estrogen dominance in both men and women. That would be like man boobs in men and weight gain in women, potential autoimmune issues. basically creating a hyper reactive immune system. So you've got increased risk for things like asthma and acne and things of that nature. And even like this combination of diabetes and obesity called diabesity. And there's, you know, a whole number of environmental toxins and chemicals and plastic that can contribute to obesity, because when you are exposed to plastics, toxins, things that your body can't metabolize, you tend to store that in fat tissue. So your body creates new fat cells to store that. So a huge number of issues when it comes to non-BPA based plastic. And that's why there are certain plastics that you should avoid. So if you look at like a plastic bottle, there's typically seven different numbers that you could see. And each of those numbers reflects something different. Like plastic number one is what you'd see in like the big, like 2 liter soda bottles or like peanut butter jars. Like it's the thicker plastic. It's kind of rigid, but it's relatively lightweight. The problem is that can break down when it gets exposed to heat or when it gets exposed to light. So plastic number one is one that can be dangerous if you've got like, you know, you leave a water bottle in your car and it gets hot, for example, and that's plastic number one, not such a great thing. That's one that can break down and build up in your body. And that would be one non-BPA-based plastic. Plastic number two would be like the type of plastic you'd find in like a detergent bottle or like a milk jug. It's a really sturdy plastic. It's a little bit less leaching. So technically from a plastic standpoint, it is a safer plastic than number one. So number two, it's called high density polyethylene. You still get some leaching, but it's not bad for beverage and food storage. It's a little bit more dishwasher safe. It's a little bit more able to withstand high temperatures. You know, I'm still going to give you some alternatives to plastics that we personally use in our house, but if you had to choose plastics, like number two isn't that bad. Plastic number three is what you'd find in like plastic pipes. You find it in shrink wrap. You find it in like salad dressing containers. It's called polyvinyl chloride. And that one's a pretty bad one. It contains phthalates, and those mimic human hormones and are pretty bad. And if they wash out into the water, they affect fish. They affect like ocean life. It's kind of a nasty one. So that's polyvinyl chloride.
Isn't PVC what we make, what we use for plumbing in houses?
Yep, exactly. So,
dude, that's not cool.
Yeah, not such a great solution. You know, especially if it gets heated up. So another one is plastic number four, and that's called low density polyethylene. You'll find that in like trash can liners, like garbage can liners, stuff like that. It's pretty flexible. It's relatively microwave proof, relatively dishwasher safe, relatively heat stable, and kind of like plastic number two, one of the least damaging of the plastics. So number two and number four are two okay numbers. Number five is another one. It's called polypropylene. And you're going to find that in like bottle caps, drinking straws, stuff like that. That's also pretty resistant to heat and a decent option. So two, four, and five so far are the decent ones. One and three, especially if you're going to drink out of them or eat out of them, would be ones to avoid. Number six is polystyrene, and that's like styrofoam basically. So you're going to find that like in styrofoam peanuts and in some plastic tableware and like those to-go containers that you get from the Chinese restaurant. That is a major component of plastic debris in the ocean, where it gets pretty toxic for marine life. It's hard to recycle. It's not one that I'm a fan of using just, for the consideration of our planet. So plastic number six, basically styrofoam, not a good one. Plastic number seven is basically anything else. It's like food containers made out of something called Lexan, Tupperware, pretty much any other plastic that's not number one through number six. Polycarbonate is probably the most well-known one, and it leaches a lot of BPA. Most plastic number sevens are not all that great. So two, four, and five would be kind of the better plastics to use if you were going to use a plastic. But then there was this relatively new form of plastic that popped up in the past decade, considered to be a safe plastic, a BPA-free plastic that was supposed to be really heat stable, really chemical resistant, really resistant to plastic degradation. And it was made by, it's branded as something called Triton. TRITAN, and it's also known as copolyester. And Triten is something that you'll find used by like Nalgene and Camelback and a lot of these other companies that are making BPA-free products. One of the problems, though, is that there was a recent study that found that BPA is not free of what's called estrogenic activity, which means that it can actually be a hormonal disruptor. And what we thought BPA-free plastics specifically were safe, they are indeed potentially harmful and can leach and aren't necessarily the safest thing on the face of the planet if you want every advantage possible. There is even some evidence that some of these BPA-free plastics might be even more estrogenic than BPA itself, especially if they get heated. So it really is kind of an issue, especially if you're putting these BPA-free plastics into the microwave or into a dishwasher or leave them out in the dashboard of your car in the sun. They actually did a bunch of tests on these and found that just like normal contact with food or water in slightly heated situations was enough for the chemicals to leach into the food and into the water. So it's kind of ironic that, you know, for example, we've all been led to believe that like Nalgene bottles are the ones to buy when in fact that may not be the case. So as far as what we do in our house, when we pack lunch for our kids, for example, a couple of things we do. We use something called Lunchbots, which are stainless steel containers that we put their food into. So Jessa, when she sends the kids off to school, puts she makes like little sushi rolls, a lot of times like carrots and celeries, some flaxseed crackers, sometimes like some hummus or some type of like a goat cheese.
Did you learn how to say that when you're in Israel?
Yes, hummus, and then tahini is trina. So yes.
Nice.
Or falafel. anyways, though, so Jessa usually makes the kids a lunch the night before they go to school, and she puts them into these lunch bots, which are stainless steel. And you can get those off of like Amazon. I'll put links in the show notes if you want to go to the lunch bot page on Amazon. And that's one thing that we use them for. Their water, we use a stainless steel container for them called Clean Canteen.
And I've seen those all over the place.
Yeah, and Clean Canteen makes water bottles too, not just for kids, but also for adults. And that's, again, a stainless steel container. And that, or like drinking out of glass mason jars or glass jars or glass cups, is a much, much better bet than plastic. We use Pyrex containers in our house for storing food. And those are just glass containers. The lid itself is plastic, but when you think about it, that's not as big of a deal because typically the lid isn't coming in contact with the food.
Yeah.
Unless you're like me and you put way, way too much food in these glass containers, and then you shove the lid on. And of course, the lid.
So then you just have to avoid the top layer.
Yeah, just don't lick the lid. But Pyrex glass containers are really good for storing food, along with glass mason jars. And then Clean Canteens, the stainless steel version, for drinking fluids and water. And you can use those on a bicycle too, by the way. And then Lunchbots for actually packing food for kids or adults. You know, if you're going to the office or whatever with packed lunch, those Lunchbots work pretty well. So those are some of the better alternatives. It's still one of those things where it's really, really tough, especially if you're like an athlete who's like competing in events where they're going to be handing you a plastic bottle no matter what. You know, you got to grab that, you got to drink out of it, and you got to kind of roll with the punches, right? You can't live life in a bubble. But try as much as possible, especially when you're at home and you can control the environment, to use glass and stainless steel. And that's what we do.
Hello. My question is a rather complicated one regarding hormones. The positive effects related to fasting seems to be quite evident. You have an effect, for instance, with human growth hormone, as well as, for instance, you're boosting your immune systems, possibly rebooting completely your immune system, system after 24 hours of fasting. So the question is, if you're doing this, fasting 24 hours and training, and by training getting positive effects via testosterone, that seems to be a really powerful way of combining health and training. Is that the case, first of all? And secondly, is there a reason to suspect that that could be a good thing also for kids? Maybe they instead need to really get into fat-burning mode, thus reducing also insulin growth factor 1, that seems to be a very, very negative aspect of carbs loading and carbs diets. For kids, it seems like insulin growth factor is one contributing factor for them entering into puberty too early, reduced height and so forth.
All right, everybody, go into your closet and find your propeller hat. I feel that this one's going to get sciencey.
No, I'll try and keep this relevant. Well, no, I won't. Actually, I lied. I'm not going to keep it that simple. Okay. No. So
go for it.
So here's the deal. There was recently a research study that was released by Brad Schoenfeld. I think it was in the National Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. And it talked about how both fasted and non-fasted exercise can improve body composition, and that both of them are relatively equal when it comes to burning body fat. I actually tweeted about this, and I noted that it would have been interesting to see some of the biohacks that I use and that I encourage my clients and our listeners to use when they're doing fasted exercise, right? Like doing your fasted exercise after a cold shower so that you increase your activity of brown adipose tissue, or doing your fasted exercise with caffeine in your system so that you get a slight upregulation of fatty acid oxidation, right? So you take a cold shower, you have a cup of coffee, and then you do like your fasted exercise after that. So some of those little biohacks weren't taken into consideration in that study. But the other thing that wasn't taken into consideration was that fasted exercise goes way above and beyond just like trying to burn a little extra body fat. And there's a lot of cool things that happen when you exercise in a fasted state. So one of the things that does indeed happen when we look at this from like a potential body composition standpoint is when you fast, you get improved insulin sensitivity. So as most of us know, when you eat, your body releases insulin, which is a hormone, which helps you absorb the nutrients from your food, which helps you, for example, shove glucose into muscle tissue or into liver, or even sometimes into fat cells to be used as energy later on. And your amount of insulin sensitivity that you have and the need for more or less insulin is affected by fasting, and fasting specifically improves insulin sensitivity. The other thing that it does, though, is that it increases production of human growth hormone. And there was one study that showed that 24 hours without food increased growth hormone production by 2,000% in men.
Holy crap.
And by 1,300% in women.
Wow.
And in addition to that, it has an effect on testosterone, meaning it increases testosterone, and that is probably because of that increase in human growth hormone. So the thing is, as far as human growth hormone, that increase in human growth hormone helps to preserve muscle tissue. It's very anabolic. It helps you store more energy and more like nutrient substrates as glycogen rather than as fat, and it helps you engage in lipolysis. So you break down your own fat, you release free fatty acids and glycerol, and then you metabolize those to create energy. And they've seen that human growth hormone will increase even after an overnight fast, but it was something like intermittent fasting, where, for example, you stop eating at 7 p.m. and you start eating again at like 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. 13 hours is the shortest period of time that's been shown to cause a really significant increase in human growth hormone production by your pituitary gland. So you don't have to do a full day fast. You can do intermittent fasting to increase this human growth hormone. Now, so just stepping back here, we know that fasting can increase human growth hormone and testosterone. We also know, and I talk about this quite a bit in my book, Beyond Training, that fasting can decrease inflammation, that it can decrease the rate at which telomere shortens, so it has like an anti-aging effect. It can help with burning fatty acids, depending on whether or not you're using some of those little biohacks I talked about earlier. And so there's a lot of benefits. But Johan asks a couple interesting questions. First of all, he says, if you are fasting and training to get the positive effects of testosterone, is that a powerful way to combine health and training? Now, here is the issue. These studies that have shown people to have an increase in human growth hormone when they fast, we're not necessarily looking at hard and heavy training in a fasted state. They were just looking at fasting itself. Once you throw in hard training as a way to increase growth hormone or increase testosterone when fasted, then you're putting your body into a potentially catabolic state. And this is why I'm a fan of, if you're going to exercise in a fasted state, keeping things very aerobic. And I actually just wrote an article for quickanddirtytips.com about how the best scenario is to find your fat burning zone, which is generally the heart rate at which you start to breathe hard and your muscles start to burn. You take that heart rate and you subtract 20 beats, and that's your approximate fat burning zone. And that would be the zone at which you'd exercise when you're in a fasted state, if you want to avoid that catabolic effect where you would potentially have a unfavorable testosterone to cortisol ratio. So that's one thing to bear in mind, is that combining fasting and training is okay, and you could still get some of the human growth hormone boosting effects of fasting, but you wouldn't want to do lots of hard and heavy training, like weight training or high intensity interval training in that fasted state. Now, once we jump into kids and helping to control insulin-like growth factor in kids, this is a really interesting consideration, is whether or not, you know, kids should be fasting to help control IGF-1 and to increase their human growth hormone. So I'll get into why kids are potentially going through puberty earlier and some of the issues with HGH and IGF-1 to kind of step back and give you the big picture for those of you who aren't aware of this problem. Basically, kids are going through puberty much earlier nowadays. Now, as far as what's normal, girls have always developed earlier than boys. You usually see girls go through puberty like between the age of 8 and 12, and boys somewhere between like 9 and 14 years old. But the new normal, based off studies that they've done, have found that girls are going through puberty like closer to like 8 or 9 years old, and boys are going through puberty a little bit before the age of 10. So it's changed really, really significantly. Like in if you look at one study, they found that in 1860, the year 1860, the average age of the onset of puberty in girls was 16 years old. And then in 1920, it was 14 years old. And in 1950, it was 13 years old. And in 1980, it was 12 years old. And by 2010, it drops to 10 years old. And so, wow. And then in African-American girls, like it was going down to 8 years old. And for Asian girls, it was dropping down to around 9 years old. So really, really weird trend in this onset of puberty. As far as why, there's a lot of different speculation as to why. They're saying that stress, physical, emotional, relationship, and lifestyle stress based on us living in a more stressful environment could potentially be one of the reasons for this. They say that light cycles, like longer periods of time spent exposed to artificial light, especially at night, having that body in a constant, basically what would be called like a constant summer state, could potentially cause this. Chemical exposure, some of the plastics that we talked about earlier, as well as the hormones and chemicals that we're finding in like meats and milks and things of that nature, could also be causing this. It's probably a cluster of symptoms. It's really, really tough to say, but one of the bigger issues here would likely be endocrine disruptors that we find in a lot of the plastics that I just got done talking about, as well as any environmental chemical pollutant like herbicides, pesticides, a lot of the plastic preservatives that are found in like cosmetic products, plastic toys, hairsprays, deodorants, you know, car fresheners, shampoo, nail polish, perfumes. We just took our kids to Disneyland yesterday, and when I took them there, because we're on vacation in Long Beach right now, When we took them there, they gave us like a car air freshener, like when we came in through the parking lot. And the first thing that I did was pull up and throw it in the garbage can. And my boys are like, "Why, that smelled nice, Dad." And I'm like, "Yeah, it smelled nice, guys. But actually, that nice smell is really, really bad for you." And I just toss in the trash. Like car air fresheners are one of those things, among others, that are one of these issues when it comes to a lot of these environmental pollutants that could potentially be causing us to go through puberty earlier. There was one really, really interesting study where there was this chemical spill of an insecticide called DDT, which we use as like a mosquito spray. Mm-hmm. And what happened was they had a chemical spill, and the alligators, the male alligators living in the lake, started going through puberty earlier. And I have no clue how they studied that or why they studied it or how you actually were grabbing alligators and seeing how early they went through puberty and somehow correlating that to a chemical spill.
They were just looking in their armpits to see if they had hair yet.
Yes, exactly. So seeing when they start rebelling against their parents.
Exactly.
But basically, really, really interesting. And so it's probably very chemical based. Now, one of the things that we know is that when you get increased exposure to hormones, specifically the type of things you would find in some of these endocrine disruptors and endocrine mimickers, and also in like meats and like milk from commercial dairy and stuff like that, you get an increase in insulin-like growth factor, which is also known as IGF. And this increase in IGF-1 can be one of the things that also correlates to an increase in human growth hormone and causes you to go through puberty earlier. So when we step back and look at this, an increase in human growth hormone or an increase in IGF-1 brought on by, for example, long periods of time spent fasting would not necessarily be a way to control puberty in kids. If you think about it from a logical standpoint, you know, putting kids through fasted scenarios like that might actually cause an earlier onset of puberty by causing an increased production of human growth hormone and possibly an increase in some of that insulin-like growth factor as well. I think that'd be a much, much better idea to just, you know, give your kids lunch-bought stainless steel containers, glass food, you know, detox your house, use natural personal care products and household cleaning chemicals, you know, keep them away from mosquito repellents and herbicides and pesticides by, you know, giving them organic fruits and vegetables and all that type of stuff, rather than having your kids fast, which I think potentially could cause them to go through puberty earlier. Unless I am confusing Johan's question here, I think this is basically not such a great idea to have your kids fast. Plus, they would probably hate you anyways if you have them fast for long periods of time. But yeah, I mean, that's the big picture. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that was remarkably easy to follow, even though it was very science-y.
Yes.
My propeller hat is working well today.
Well, if you saw my podcasting environment today, you would understand why I'm so... Is cogent the word? Cogent?
Cogent, yes.
Cogent, yes. Why I'm so cogent. I'm actually standing right now, which of course we all know that increases your brain-derived neurotrophic factor and makes you smarter. But I'm standing in the small bedroom of a rented house in Long Beach with my microphone propped up on four pillows, my laptop on a chair with the chair on top of the bed, and then children running around and playing downstairs. So it's really, really interesting scenario.
Yeah, it does sound like you're recording in a kindergarten.
Yes, there are children playing downstairs. So if the podcast audio sounds a little bit different today, that's why. It's vacation.
Blame Disneyland.
Vacation Long Beach. That's right. Blame Disneyland. So anyways, though, resources for all this stuff, we're going to put them over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/300, along with the discount for UCAN, the discount for Onnit, some of the studies that we talked about, the Unbeatable Mind Retreat, the Getaway in Dubai, my Rev Yourself Conference, and all the other things that we talked about during the Q&A. But then also, we are going to send out an official Ben Greenfield Fitness gear pack to one lucky listener, as they say in Canada, huzzah, or as we say here in America, hooray.
Don't you say yahoo?
Happy, happy, joy, joy.
Yeehaw.
Yeehaw.
Something like that.
So anyways, we have a review from Bluto, who says, how my mornings went from simple to super. What do you think, Brock? You want to take this one?
Mm-hmm. It goes like this. Dear Ben and Brock, this podcast seriously revolutionized my life. I never thought I'd go out and buy Himalayan crystal salt lamp and an air purifier until the day you guys rewired my brain to take control of my environment, of the environment I live in. Mm. Also, I switched to Dr. Bronner's soap, and I noticed it has relieved my hives that would occasionally break out. That's good.
Yeah. That's good.
Nobody wants hives.
Yeah, that's... a little TMI, but okay.
We didn't say where. Yeah. I'm assuming it's a guy.
Yeah.
Might be wrong there. I learned so much from you guys. I want to thank you guys for an awesome show that I eagerly wait for every Wednesday and Saturday while I eat my morning acai?
Acai bowl.
Acai bowl. What's an acai bowl?
It's like a bowl that has like acai berries and like fruits and stuff in it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Very hippie.
And sit next to the hot oven on a cold fall morning. Thanks.
Wow.
Mateo.
Wow.
Is that really... is that some sort of a sign off? Like yeah. Namaste?
No, I think Mateo. That's Mateo's actual name. That's a lot of stuff. A Himalayan crystal salt lamp, an air purifier, Dr. Bronner soap for your hives. Sorry about those. Your morning acai bowl and your hot oven on a cold fall morning. Amazing. Wow. This guy's like a walking, talking like testimonial for everything that we've ever recommended on the podcast.
Mateo.
So yeah, Mateo, write us an email, ben@bengreenfieldfitness.com. Send us your address, and we are going to send you a cool tech t-shirt, a water bottle, and a beanie cap. And so if you're listening in and you also are covered in Dr. Bronner's soap, sitting next to your Himalayan crystal salt lamp and hunched over eating out of your acai bowl, hopefully with a bamboo spoon, not a plastic spoon, then you can go leave your review at iTunes. And if you hear us read your review, then we will send you a sweet Ben Greenfield Fitness gear pack. Or you can just support the show by going to bengreenfieldfitness.com/gear and ordering a pack for yourself. So
going to start saying that at the end of every yoga class. I'd just be like, Mateo.
So bengreenfieldfitness.com/giveaway. Get in on that biomat contest for our American listeners. Happy Turkey Day /Thanksgiving for our UK listeners. Sorry that we kicked the Redcoats' butt 200 and some odd years ago, and we are now. Is that why we celebrate? No, was that 4th of July?
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm getting my history mixed up. Yeah, Thanksgiving is when we came over with the pilgrims. And
that's when you brought smallpox and wiped out all the indigenous people.
And ate corn nuts with the Native Americans. So,
yeah, which is a really nice thing to celebrate.
I'm still going to snub all of our London listeners about how we beat the Redcoats.
I could bring up the time that the Canadians burnt down the White House in the War of 1812.
Yes, and to all of our Native American listeners, thank you for teaching us about popcorn.
And sorry
for what? Oh, yeah.
Everything.
Everything. By the way, I did just find out my wife is, I think, 1/16th Native American. So, no, 1/8th Native American. Kids are 1/16th Native American. Found out her dad's like 1/4 Native American.
How did she not know that?
I don't know, but she could have gotten so many more like college scholarships. So, yeah. Oh, well, total segue. But anyways, Ben Greenfield Fitness, we got to end this thing. BenGreenfieldFitness.com/300. Check it out and have a wonderful week.
Visit BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.